You're listening to Signal to Noise, part of the ProSound Web Podcast Network, proudly brought to you this week by the following sponsors. Allen & Heath, introducing their new CQ series, a trio of compact digital mixers for musicians, bands, audio engineers, home producers, small venues, and installers that puts ease of use and speed of setup at the heart of the user experience. RCF, who has just unveiled their new TT Plus audio brand, including the high-performance GTX series line arrays and the GTS 29 subwoofer. Be sure to check it out at rcf-usa.com. That's rcf-usa.com. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Signal to Noise. I'm your host, Andy Levis, and with me in the virtual studio, as always, is my co-host, Sean Walker. What's up, Sean?
What's up, dude? What's up, y'all? How are you guys doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Did you guys go rage for New Year's? We had a pretty chill New Year's at home with the kids. We had a bonfire and then, you know, watched the ball drop and the fireworks of the Space Needle and called it. We're old at this point, I think.
We were decidedly the youngest folks at the event we went to. We found a little jazz bar here in Westchester that is actually a former studio, or I guess a current studio owner in the area, who decided he was tired of giving advice to friends on how to do a jazz club, so he was just going to open up his own.
All right, fair enough.
And went there.
Way to put your money where your mouth is, buddy.
Yeah, and had a pretty good time, decent food, decent tunes, you know, something to do, easy ride home.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, hung out, did that, and then went on a hike yesterday, as you apparently do. Apparently that's a thing. Like the first hike, I didn't know, but yeah, apparently it's a thing.
All right, we did the polar bear plunge. My wife and my 9-year-old daughter Rowan, they went and jumped in the river and did their polar bear plunge yesterday. And Rowan was like, "I want to go again," and we're like, "No, dude, you're 9. Like, you're not jumping in the ice cold river again."
I'm actually gonna pop over and let's introduce our guest for this week, who is a very old friend of mine. And to clarify, we have been friends for a long time. He is not very old, Jim Van Bergen. And Jim, we were talking beforehand, and I was introducing him to Sean, and it's almost easier to list the things Jim hasn't done as opposed to the things Jim done, because he's done a whole lot of different things: TV, film at one point, Broadway, music. He's currently the house sound at one of the venues at Jazz and Lincoln Center here in New York. He works on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. He had a tenure for many years working on the New Year's Eve broadcast from Times Square. There's some Blue Man in his history.
Sadly. Yeah.
But welcome, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Not too bad. You know, thanks for hopping in with us. You've been on my short list of friends I was going to sucker into joining us for a while, so I'm glad we can make it happen today.
Consider me suckered. Happy to welcome add a little to Thunderdome. Bit of a, thank you. Here's the harmonic distortion to add into your day.
Yeah, right?
So it's always fun playing the game of, you know, we're doing an audio podcast, so what microphones do people show up with? Like, I meant to mention it when we had TC Furlong on the other week. I'm blanking on what they are, the little egg-like EVs, the Tom mics.
Yeah, with the ND627 or...
Yeah, there's a 6 in there somewhere, yeah, which was one of the highlights. But Jim, is that you rocking a Neumann there?
Yeah, I'm rocking a TLM 102, but I had to have a lot of choices. So the choices I had close by is I have a what the hell is this, Telefunken M80 that I brought to listen to, and I listened to that and was like, oh, it sounds, you know, kind of like the Riverside thing. I brought a little Contact plug-on element that's designed to go with an RTS. Key panel, you know, McCurdy key panel microphone. I was like, well, there's the super cheap version of it. I brought an Earthworks Lectern microphone.
Jim came prepared.
Yeah, I brought an old school Sennheiser ME80 with the KU extension. And this actually sounds really, really good. But I decided I wanted to have the large diaphragm Neumann.
There we go.
Size matters.
You know, I gotta say, I was skeptical of the shotgun as like a Zoom or like podcasting mic, my partner Kate that's been her mic of choice at home to kind of narrow out the room a bit, and it sounds pretty fantastic.
Surprisingly good. And you can put them outside of, you know, your video if you're doing the Zoom kind of call. So it's really convenient.
But if you're doing that, you need a little like figurine of a guy in tight pink shorts and nothing else in the desert holding it over your head, right?
Having done that, I don't want to be the guy in the tight pink shorts.
That's for those who don't know, Google Star Wars boom guy later. It's an iconic image for those who are not familiar.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were shooting in Tunis, you know, Tunisia. And, you know, it was very, very hot out there. So, of course, he's wearing, you know, like flip-flops or sneakers and tight pink shorts and skinny boom dude.
Yep.
It's an image. You won't lose it. Once you've got it in your head, you won't lose it.
I think I'm going to skip that particular web search and just, you know, take your word for it.
I mean, there's I was going go to go that for Halloween Google. With the way global warming's going lately.
That sounds fascinating.
Unfortunately, Jim's now got a drink because he just pictured that in his head.
That's right. That's as it. You can see, I'm drinking bourbon with one cube.
All right. So,
for the Jim, listeners on the podcast, you'll have to miss the verbal or the visual jokes. Sorry.
It's more fun in their minds. Jim, why don't we give us a little bit of the JVB origin story? Because, like I said, you've done a whole lot of stuff. Where do you start?
So, classically trained as a musician and an actor, as a performer, and was doing that, was being paid, as a kid. I was, you know, as in my first commercial when I was like three, was a singer and, you know, did a lot of musical theater, played in a bunch of bands, through college, was making my living, was being paid as an actor and being paid as a musician. Kind of had an aha moment in the middle of band rehearsal with one of my rock bands and was like, if I don't really want to be here, should I be doing this for a living? It's kind of like, I really don't want to be in rehearsal, so maybe it's time to listen to the world. And, you know, it was a point where I thought maybe I'd change directions and get out of the performance part and try to see what it was like to actually study sound design. And so I went up to New Haven and spent some time with David Budrys. At the school that shall not be named, the Yale School of Drama, which is now the David Geffen School of Drama. You know, went to school with people like John Huntington and Jamie Anderson and some other folks who are, you know, good friends, and studied and learned a lot more than I thought, and then came to New York and jumped in with both feet, started writing for Theater Crafts and Lighting Dimensions magazines while I was starving as a sound designer and breaking into the industry here. Working in the publishing game, there's no money in it, but it's good contacts. And I started meeting a lot of folks. And at the same time I was doing that, since I had my own DAT recorder and my own microphones, I started working in cheap film production and started doing a lot of film work and was doing some television work before I was able to break into off-Broadway and eventually into Broadway. So that was one realm. I started working with concert sound consultants and did 3 years touring with the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic and the Carlos Moseley Sound Pavilion, which is a really fascinating sound system, doing the summer parks tours. After that, took a job designing with Big Apple Circus and Blue Man Group and spent several years focusing on, you know, the design career. Was a resident sound designer at Primary Stages and, there's another theater company that's on 42nd Street, Signature Theater Company. I was resident for them for several years. At the same time, I designed like 7 or 8 seasons with Big Apple Circus. And while at the same time I was doing Blue Man Group, they had already been designed head shows in New York and Boston. And I designed the Chicago production and oversaw the 3 North American productions at that point before they kind of exploded. It was fascinating, you know. Did a lot of Broadway work. When my first daughter was born, I started mixing more Broadway because I was just looking to get benefits, health benefits through the union. So I did a little more behind the console work instead of, you know, more design work. And at that point, Chris Cronin, who's a buddy of mine who works at Sound Associates, and he's a freelance sound designer and engineer, we were both looking to do a little more music, and so we bought a remote recording truck from a friend of ours, and we spent like 4 or 5 years doing a crap ton of video and remote work, multi-track recording in the early days of digital.
Oh, that's why. Mm-hmm. Because I remember you having the truck. I didn't realize that Chris was the other partner in that.
Yeah, yeah. So it was Cronin and me, and we did some spectacular stuff. We did at least three seasons of HBO's Reverb. Did a ton of stuff for you know, ABC and MTV, a bunch of live albums. Actually, Shane McGowan just passed, and probably one of my favorite things was we recorded Across the Broad Atlantic, which was his Shane McGowan and the Popes double live album, which was two different performances, one on that side of the Atlantic and one on this side of the Atlantic on St. Patty's Day, because that year they'd had a breakout of hoof and mouth disease or whatever it is in the UK. And so they recorded on St. Patrick's Day and two different days and made a double album out of it. And that's one of my most favorite, you know, album credits.
Do you remember recording on St. Patrick's Day, or was the Jameson just, you know, keeping everybody well looped?
Oh, I remember it very, very well, because it is a story and a half.
All right, hit me.
Go on.
I like stories, because no good story ever started with the salad was crisp. So
there you go.
St. Patty's Day is that's right up my alley of a good story.
There you go. So, all right. So, and I had done a bunch of, you know, crazy broadcasts, some really insane broadcasts, and had some stupid stories from that. I had done a lot of rock and roll and had some crazy stories from that. But this one kind of took the cake. You know, we went in and did setup. We were shooting at Webster Hall, and, you know, it was totally a sold out show. St. Patrick's Day, a little crazy outside. Everyone was very happy because the weather was starting to get nice. Executive producer was panicking because Shane had been in country, but nobody had seen him. Like, Shane's here. Trying to find out where he is. Finally, he gets a phone call. This is kind of early in the days of our cell phones, right? We had cell phones. They were expensive. You know, he had a UK cell phone. He was really complaining every time that he answered it because, like, this is costing me pound after pound after pound. But finally found out where Shane was. He'd been drinking for 3 days straight with a mate that he'd seen when he got off the plane at JFK and had not stopped. So I was like, okay, that's the problem with New York City, is they don't ever shut the bars down, you know?
Finally, is it a problem, though? Is it really a problem?
Well, here's the thing. A limo finally pulls up and a bunch of security guys go out there and they pull this guy out and they carry him on their shoulders like he's a dead body into the building and up the stairs. And
oh,
I was like,
no.
I was like, that's Shane. And he's like, uh-huh. I was like, he's pissed drunk. I'm like, okay, great. So they're going to shovel some coffee in him. They're going to get him in a shower. They're going to get him out there. So, you know, about an hour later, you know, we'd done a line check, keeping our fingers crossed, band starts to play, somebody pushes Shane out towards the microphone, you know, I roll into, oh God, I'm trying to remember what the song was. I want to say Grace of God. And Shane sidles with the microphone and starts spewing into it. And I mean, you know, spewing words, not vomit. But I was like, is he singing in Gaelic? Because I can't understand a thing he's saying. And the producer goes, nah, man, he's fucking pissed. He's so drunk. You cannot understand a syllable he is slurring. But it was an iconic performance. It was a spectacular show. The audience was on fire. He was in surprisingly okay shape for an absolute shit-faced person. And I didn't think that it was going to be spectacular. I was like, this is never going to make it to air. And it sure as hell did. It made it to a double album that sold very, very well. It was crazy, crazy performance. And
dude, how awesome.
You know, yeah, I go back and listen to it from time to time. And I have a bunch of friends who are like, oh my God, I love that piece. I love that album. It's, you know, something I'm really, really proud of. I go back and listen to it. And I'm like, well, it's all there. You know, everything's right there. It's, you know, it's spectacular. And it's a really fun version of Fairy Tale of New York. You know, Shane's going, oh, it's Rachel. And I'm like, oh God, please don't vomit on her. You know, it's like, Rachel. And, you know, we're looking at him. We had a spy camera, you know, we're looking at the guy and like, he had like three teeth left in his head, you know, from the years of alcohol and drugs. And God bless him, you know, tortured soul, you know, a brilliant, prolific sound, songwriter. What a crazy guy, you know, but that was a really spectacular show to do.
Dude, I bet. How cool.
Done some wild stuff, you know. That was one of them.
Yeah, right? So, totally.
So you mentioned that sound pavilion and teased that was like kind of a wild sound system, so I'm curious to hear more about that.
The Carlos mostly sound pavilion. So it was designed to take the acoustic experience of being in the Metropolitan Opera House to outdoors and to do that for over 100,000 people. And so it was a series of deployed sound towers. They'd be taken out, you know, by a forklift and placed. And that was done very, very diligently by a team of sound folks. We had surveying equipment, you know, so we would shoot lasers out and do exact measurements to where the towers would go. So you'd bring in the main stage. It was a 7-truck setup for the main stage for the Met and the Philharmonic. And not a huge front mains hang, a very small main hang, because most of what was coming off the stage, you know, was direct from the orchestra. And then most of what was coming out of, for the reinforced part, was coming out of the Carlos Mozart Sound Pavilion, which are these deployed speaker towers, which were front, side, rear, and bottom firing. So they had a subwoofer built into them. They, you know, they had the ability to give you early reflections in addition to a direct sound. So it was a really fascinating project. It was a lot of fun to set up. Took considerable time, very different than doing a normal outside gig, you know, not like going in and setting up a rig and going, here's my line array, you know, left, center, right, subs, maybe delays, done. It's like, this is all delays, and it's very, very delicate. It has to be, you know, timed very specifically. The placement of each tower was really particular, so it took hours to do. But it was amazing, and we'd had up to 1 million people with that sound system, and it was spectacular stuff. And, you know, toured it all around the tri-state area, from New Jersey to Long Island to Pennsylvania, and did that for several different years and learned a lot, met a lot of people, had a spectacular time. It was
a
really
million people.
Yeah. Outdoors.
What is the energy like at a event with a million people attending?
Oh,
is that insane?
I mean, no, because it's classical music. So it was very chill. Like classical music, very chill. Now, I've done a million people live in a much worse situation where I was in the remote truck in the center of Times Square, you know, 1998 into 1999, you know, 2.5 million people surrounding Times Square and more people in the millennium, you know, crazy energy. And that is a very frightening energy because it's a lot of youngsters, it's a lot of drunk people, it's a lot of partygoers, and they're just there to have a great time. They want to go
on
TV.
Hey, I'm sitting right here, man. I said I was sorry. It was one time I knocked into the truck. I said sorry.
I have no problem with most drunk people. I have lots and lots of interesting stories about shows where
I mean, you're in the music
terrified.
Business, of course. You don't
yeah, exactly. You know, I was mixing. Oh my god, years and years ago. So this is around that same time period. But I was mixing Britney Spears at the World, which used to be the Paramount Theater, right? And now it's the Hard Rock Cafe. But she was doing a special, like, you know, New Year's Eve event, and, you know, on the stage, there's like 1500 people in the audience, you know, it's chock full, and people start throwing champagne bottles, you know, and I remember like ducking under a piece of Visqueen, trying to cover up the Heritage 3000 console, going, please do not pour the champagne on the mixing console. Please do not hit the sound engineer with champagne bottle.
Dude, totally. Oh my gosh.
Insanity. So, you know, people have a good time. We'll have too much of a good time sometimes.
Fair enough.
I was doing a TV broadcast for the Giants ticker tape parade, and we're in a mobile unit down near the Canyon of Heroes, right? Giants are coming through, and the fans are so excited and have spent a long time pre-gaming, and they're, you know, hopping up on the outside of the mobile vehicle trying to get a better view of the football players, right? And the van, you know, the TV truck is rocking back and forth. You know, we're going, oh my god, you know, gonna have problems here. You know, we start having interference, you know, with the satellite and some of the RF
dude.
Cameras and RF microphones. Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes crowds can be your worst enemy.
Oh,
so
no,
good times,
right? Totally.
Mm-hmm. I got an Emmy nomination for that, but it wasn't one of my wins.
Hey man, even a nomination is better than nothing.
It's true. Actually, so having talked about that kind of insanity, when we did the ticker tape parade for the women's soccer team, we did it remotely. And that's one of the things I did get an Emmy Award for, was because we did everything wirelessly. I actually was in a truck and we mixed and broadcast it in southern Jersey while the parade happened in the southern tip of Manhattan, right? and everything was microwaved over. And so technically it was spectacular. So it was, you know, it was a really unusual thing to do, and to have all those elements. Yeah. Was very, very cool. And I'm actually really, really proud of that. And I have my little gold statue for it.
Yay. Nice. Good work.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm really proud of my few awards, but I'm married to a director producer and she has like 25. And so there's an awards cabinet and it's chock full of her awards, and I have a couple way in the back and I want to keep it work. And, you know.
So, you know, mine are the top shelf ones, so we tuck them away.
Yeah, right. Totally. That's funny. Yeah. All right. So since I'm not in broadcast and stuff, how do you technically set up a truck in New Jersey and do something that's in Manhattan? How does that work to do it all wirelessly?
Well, you have a lot of very high powered satellite dishes that are involved, and you do embedding of audio. So you have to spend time QCing your microphones to match gain to the picture in each location. So we'd set up a camera. You know, there's a lot of advanced time on this, right? So we know weeks in advance that we're going to do it. So we start, you know, going into spotting locations during the parade route. Where can we put a camera that will be isolated, that will be protected, that won't be problematic, where we can capture a good shot, you know, of the parade moving and of audience. And so wherever we put those cameras, and trying to figure out where to put microphones on. If there's a mobile, camera, you know, I put a microphone attached to it, and I hope I will get more audience response or ambient noise than I will cameraman responding or whatever the sound of the vehicle is that it's on, right? Like a couple years ago when we had Pope Francis coming through, the microphones I had on the mobile cameras was just, you know, vehicle noise. It was bum, 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 bum. And then the sounds of the sirens, you know, that were accompanying, you know, the Pope as he's going through. So not any usable audio with Pope Frank on that part of the trip. But, you know, with the Kenya Parade of Heroes and the women's soccer team, you know, placed a lot of microphones, did a lot of heavy shock mounting. You know, if I had to gaff tape a mount into place, you know, shock mount, you know, rubber mat, whatever I can, try and get it, you know, sometimes on the stop sign or next to a, you know, a big stoplight or whatever, you can, you know, clamp something onto it. You know, Manfrotto arm is your best friend onto the side of a building or something, or even on a tripod or set of legs if you have no choice, and get a decent image of, you know, how the parade's going to move, right? Trying to get a good stereo image, but ultimately, at the end of the day, I want signal, you know, more signal than noise to be able to help translate that information. And the good part of it is like doing news and like the broadcast I've done for so many years for 9/11, is there's often play-by-play or color commentary on top of it. So you want to make sure you have everything, you can tell the story, but you also know there's going to be something else going on, so you might be able to cover up a few of the mishaps, mishmash noise that goes along the way. But trying to get a really good, clean capture wherever possible. So learn that when you're doing the rest of it, you know. And the same, that's one of the things I really learned great when I was doing film, was trying to capture everything that's happening, you know, bypassing where the noise is, you know, the generators and, you know, the rest of the crew, the sounds of the dolly, and how do you get, you know, really good contact for, you know, what's happening with your actors, the ambience of what's happening in the environment, you know, get all your sound elements and your room tone and everything else you need to try and make sure you have elements to be able to put it together later in post. Was really, really helpful when I started to mix television broadcast live, because I was spending a lot of time going, you know, what is the story we're trying to tell? How do I make this happen? And it's, you know, similar to what you do in sports. You're always trying to make sure you have plenty of the effects tracks and the ambient tracks, whatever you have, all those different things, and your color and play-by-play are sitting on top of that. But you have to be able to tell the story. So if you're telling a theatrical story, television broadcast, something else, you know, or a live broadcast event, you know, all those elements are important, but you want to make sure you're able to tell the story, but have to have all those elements and go, where do they go? How do I utilize them? Where will I pull them in or put them out, you know? And how do you make that work? And you hope that all the choices that you make and the planning you do in advance is good. So, because you usually don't have a chance to fix it in post, you know, it's like you got one shot when it's live.
Dude, cool.
It can be, you know, I mean, I learned a lot about, you know, the stuff I was doing when I was doing film in the early days. So, a lot of the world of audio that was pre-digital.
Totally. Yeah, so you mentioned briefly, like Times Square, New Year's Eve, and like, because how long did you do that? And you were doing is it the pool feed you were doing?
Yes, I did the broadcast pool feed for 10 years.
Yeah, and we should explain to folks what that is.
So that is basically one TV truck and one big ass TV team does 20 some odd cameras that go throughout the course of Times Square. And that pool is paid for by the Times Square Business Improvement District, Times Square BID. And that feed is given either in signal cameras, single cameras, or as a cut feed to both the live screens locally and to every network that comes in and is part of that event. Any other company who's there, a TV network or a channel that's there, they were allowed to have a single camera, or if they had a big stage, they could have the stages of the cameras they needed locally. But they're not coming in each, like ABC, NBC, CBS, MTV, they're not all coming in with 20 and 30 cameras. The pool feed is doing 20 cameras, and they're doing all the wide sweeping shots, all the jib shots, all the stuff that's happening down at the main stage, where the mayor or whomever the guest is pushes the button, watches the ball come down. That's all pool feed cameras. And if you have, somebody doing their stand up from a particular network, that's on that network's local camera. So they're taking their stuff, which is things that are happening in their building, maybe their outside single camera, plus the pool feed. So the pool feed is feeding the entire world. And that was really cool, like 1994, 95, 95, 96, 97, 98. Started to get to the millennium, started to get crazy. So 98 and 99 was a nutty year. The year of the millennium was absolutely insane. And then it chilled out a little bit after that. And I did it up until 2005. And then we were like, I think we're done with this. Have done it enough. Did the important years. Ready to kind of move on with our lives.
Yeah, because I remember because I did 2000 to 2001 with you, and that was relatively chill. We were pleasantly and relatively warm too, I remember.
Yeah, but we'd had some tough years prior to that. David Chessman, I don't know if he's ever been a guest on your show, but David's a spectacular tech and sound guy, and he was with me since the very beginning, I think, on a bunch of those shows, and we had some fabulously terrifying days.
I think that was actually the day I met Dave Chessman was during that New Year's Eve with you, I think.
Are you changing from bourbon to rye? What just happened there?
That's the coffee is wearing off, and I haven't gone down and topped off the. I don't have my traditional podcast whiskey today because it was a little earlier than we usually record. So
knew there was something off about you, Andy.
Yeah, I'm for more coffee or more coffee whiskey,
right? I mean, there's always got to be at least one blooper in an episode. Well, I always manage to do it right out of the gate.
Damn. Bro, I am an entire episode of blooper every time. What do you mean?
It's part of your charm.
You're the talent. I'm the ding-dong. Let's rock, dude. What do you mean?
If you're the ding-dong, who's the ho-ho? I'll be the Twinkie.
Uh-oh. I don't know. Ba-dum-bum-ba-dum.
Okay. Yeah, man.
So on the New Year's, am I allowed to ask about Auld Lang Syne and your connection to that, or is that something we can't talk about?
No, we can talk about it. I mean, somebody might get a bill. Sure, go ahead.
That's one of my favorite little bits of trivia.
Which bits of trivia? Like the playback that we used for so many years?
Yep. Yeah, that one.
I mean, I put together a playlist. The music that you heard on broadcast was not actually supposed to be direct to air. It's a 24-channel surround system that Maryland Sound System. Maryland Sound put out in the square, and John Kilgore's original sound designer of the effects package that did the countdown. But I did all the other elements that went around with that, musical elements that came in and went out. And then at some point, John did not have an agreement with New Year's Eve and Times Square BID, and I took over the sound design and redesigned the surround package that went around for the sound effects and the musical package. And the whole goal with that was like the whooshes could all go direct to air, but the music packages, because it was all, it's not licensed. So it was only allowed to be picked up ambiently, right? It wasn't going direct on the broadcast, but there are so many open microphones out there in the square. You could not miss it to save your life. Right. So the music was out there in this very particular playlist, and 14, 15, 16 years straight, I kept on hearing that package go straight through. At 2004, 2005, my last year, I sold the effects and music package to the client, who operates One Time Square, right? What are they called? It's Countdown Entertainment. It's the company Countdown Entertainment. I sold that a package, the surround mix and all those elements to Countdown Entertainment. And And for years, I've just been watching that happen. And I didn't watch this year. The TV was on in the background, and I was at a nice party. We were having a great time, you know, drinking some champagne and catching up with friends. So I didn't hear what was going on in the background. It's probably something else now. But for years and years, that same package played, the same, you know, whooshes and sound effects package, which is really spectacular when you hear it in the square going around you. Then it folds down to either stereo or mono for the TV folks at home. Yeah. And then you hear the music package. But it was never supposed to be played directly because of licensing.
Nope.
So, oh, you know, but that was, you know, Auld Lang Syne and, you know, New York, New York. And then, you know, so it's a very specific, you know, playback package. And it was very, very carefully designed for 3 years leading up to the millennium and then kind of the post-millennium music package. But, you know, all New York-based style music or stuff that's all about, you know, that time of year and that package and, you know, where we are and what it is. So it's, you know, kind of the whole New York hour.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the version that lived in my memory, which may be like 20 years of memory telephone gaming after, was that like there's like, because the white noise of the crowd is so much that you can't hear it. And I thought I remembered you building like basically like a fake sequence of that. Am I misremembering or?
No, you're not inaccurate. I just wasn't ever going to share that information with most people.
Go.
So that's okay.
I can edit that out if you need.
No, it's okay. Secrets. It's, you know, business trade secrets. Things you can do that are important to know is, you know, how much of it is live and how much of it's Memorex. It, you know, you are still telling a story, and sometimes the audience is a part of that. You know, there were human elements built into the sound effects package and the music package, and there are sound effects elements built into the live package. Is that fair to say?
All right. Yeah, that tracks. And that's, and I think we touched on some stuff like that a little bit last week in the live episode we did of, yeah, like different ways to like goose a crowd and make the experience more. I'm gesturing with my hands because I don't have words, but folks at home can use their imagination. Yeah, but that's cool. And then now like the other big, like similar event that you still work on these days is the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. What's your role in that?
I am the live sound PA guy on 34th Street. So because of my television background, mixing background, Ed Green was the production mixer on that show for many, many years until his passing. Ed, here's to you in the sky, buddy. Ed had been one of my mentors in broadcast television mixing in the early 90s, as in addition to being a good friend. But when they decided to make a change with the person who was responsible on 34th Street, I was the person that Ed, NBC, and Claire Brothers, who was the PA company at that point, had in common. Ed wanted me to be the person on the street because he's like, I know JVB will make sure that all the things that happen need to happen and the mix will not be disturbed. The point of that being is that job is to mix the live event for the crowd, which are all VIPs for Macy's and NBC, right? So top brass and a few special guests, but there's a lot of major, you know, big TV stars, well-known faces, and then top executives for Macy's and NBC. Very important people. You're also mixing monitors for all the talent that's coming across 34th Street. So anybody who's singing, whether it's live or Memorex, they're all getting their mix from me. Anybody who's getting ears is getting it from me. Anybody who's listening to it through a speaker, you know, one of the many mini line arrays I have is coming from me. Or if somebody decides they want to plop down in the center of the square on the logo and get a pair of wedges, you know, I'm mixing the wedges and the wedges come out to them. So in addition to that, whatever I'm doing is going to affect the live air mix because there's so many ambient mics there. So the biggest part of my job, in addition to making sure the audience hears what they need, the talent hears what they need, you know, and everything's moving back and forth, is to not mess up the broadcast mix with the PA, right? Monitors can't ruin the rest of the show. So I'm spending a lot of time as a broadcast mixer listening to my mix and going, am I going to affect what's happening? And then listening back and going, what's happening? The word that you were looking for when you were making those gestures a few minutes ago was sweetening. And when you have a show like that, some networks might actually have a sweetening person who has the ability to add in, like, for example, when you see some sports shows, like ones where they have big rings and guys fight each other or people fight each other in the ring, and they might be more theatrical or scripted events. You know what sport I'm talking about. Right. When that makes it to air, you'll have sweetening on it. Right. There will definitely be additional crowd noises that are put in post. Right. So when that makes it to air, there's sweetening. shows that are live, like the NBC Parade, might have a sweetening mixer on, you know, so you need to have the ability to add those audience responses in places where it's necessary. So I hope I'm not going to get fired next year. See what happens. Who's listening to this from NBC right. and Macy's? Anyhow, hey, there's no surprise, right? The guys in the truck are doing the sweetening mix. So there's a separate B unit that has a music package, playback package, you know, some other elements happening. So it's a very, very big sound team. Currently, the current mixer on that show, I should say, Jorge is a very good friend of mine. He's a sweetheart of a guy. He's a very talented mixer. It's a huge number of elements that are going down live for television with that. And the lead audio A1 and the designer, the guy who puts all of it together, Chris Acker from NBC, he is spectacular. He spends most of his year doing sports, a lot of crazy setups that are technically insane for things like golf all around the world. But this is a monster show because it's hooking up you know, elements along the route, and NBC's home base at you know, 30 Rock, tying everything back and forth, and then, you know, it's multiple birds, all kinds of fiber lines back and forth, you know, and there's live commentators, there's live VOs from different locations, you know, there's so much stuff that's coming in and going out. And it's not, you know, it's not just local to what's happening there in the square and the truck compound on 34th Street. So Chris Acker's put together a spectacular system, and there's days and days of faxing to make sure those lines are working. And he's made it a very, very good turnkey system for what that show is. It's insanely big. My part of it is really large, but it's small and easy in compared to what the rest of broadcast is doing. The biggest part of what I'm doing is trying to make sure I have all my elements and I work well with the live team and with the broadcast team to try and make sure that we're not messing up any of the part of the air mix. But, you know, it's a cool gig to have, you know, and I get to see all the talent, you know, a lot of the folks I work with, all the Broadway shows, I get to see a lot of friends there, a lot of the musical artists I've worked before. So, you know, come down like, hey, I'm doing your air mix or I'm doing your wedges. Nice to see you again. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to be experiencing. You know, it's freezing cold. Feel the wind. This is what it's going to be like. You know, it's going to be chilly. It's going to be windy. You know, if you really, really want to sing live, let's make sure you can hear everything you need to hear. If you're going to be outside for an hour and not be able to warm up, you know, maybe the best idea is if you want it to sound like the record, just let it sound like the record. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a significant thing that a lot of people in the industry talk about for that show. But honestly, you know, it's not an outdoor live performance show on a stage where people can be warmed up and ready to go. It's a show where people are outside for hours on end, and you are in the worst of the weather. It's not, you know, you're not protected. The talent is not protected there at all. So it's not like doing an outdoor show at Red Rocks. You know, this is the worst of the situation. So it's a very harsh environment. And when people decide they really want to sing live, you know, God bless them. It's a tough thing to do. It's hard to pull off. Some people do it phenomenally well, but it's really hard to accomplish. And so I recommend that, you know, to most of the talent that come through, we suggest that they don't do it, honestly. I know you're not asking that question, but that's probably the biggest question people have, especially in our industry. So yeah. The folks who are listening at home going, do they really sing live? Well, most of them don't. You know, a few of them do, and God bless them. But anybody who tries to do that, it's really hard to do, especially if you're riding a float 25 or 30 feet in the air, going back and forth, trying to hit your mark, you know, trying to pay attention to where you are, listening to your click, know where you're going, you know, and then look good on television for the 30 seconds to 3 minutes that you're going to get of airtime, you know, after having been, you know, freezing outside, trying to look good for TV for an hour before you know, get a chance to open your mouth. It's tough. It's hard to pull off.
Dude, totally.
You know? And it's a monster audience too. You know, you got 60 million people in the US alone who are watching that, you know, while they're making their turkeys.
Yeah. And that's like a super interesting point to call up. Cause it's you, when you watch these broadcasts and you watch, particularly in the age of Facebook, people watching, there's always so much like armchair directing, armchair mixing of like, why isn't it live? It's so horribly lip synced. Why, you know, why are they so lazy? And it's like, they're not lazy. They're freezing fucking cold.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'd be saying, you know, if you really don't believe why we do what we do, come on down.
Yeah.
You know, come on and hang out with me a day before the broadcast and yeah, come no, have a look.
It's a for day? A reason.
No, man, make them push cases. They want to come down and see what's up. Make them go do the load in and the shot prep and the like looming and all that crap, and then make them push cases and freeze balls for 2 weeks on that load in or whatever you said it was. and then they can see the show.
Well, and that's how Jim and I became friends.
Exactly. There you go. You bring your close friends in and make them do the absolute worst possible jobs, but because you want the best people in the world doing it. So,
right.
That's yeah. So it's tough. I've had a lot of guests come in and come see it, and they're always shocked and amazed to see how big the setup actually is. You know, how huge the stage, the platform is that we use for cameras and broadcasts, and you know how large the tent is that gets used because of the number of wireless cameras, the rail cameras, you know, all the extra video that's there, all the lighting that's up there. You know, the rail cameras is doing 120 feet, you know, zooming back and forth to be able to get, you know, those 100 some odd rockets, you know, and that kick line that looks spectacular. You know, the huge overhead jib shots looking down, you know, from five floors up, you know, to get that entire overhead shot and some spectacular stuff that's going on. It's amazing television. Some really cool stuff. You know, but we get a good bit of rehearsal for what it is, but not nearly enough rehearsal for what we have to do. And my God, let me tell you, I feel bad for those kids who are in the marching bands. They'll come out and do rehearsal with us at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, running back and forth to hit their marks, you know, trying to keep their instruments warm, blowing hard, just try and get, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes on air. And then they go and they march the entire parade, and they've done that for hours, and their feet are killing them. They've been holding their horn the whole time. And then you're on, you know, boom, you got to be spectacular for those last 3 minutes.
Dude, what an intense run.
Oh, yeah. But they do a great job, you know.
That's awesome. How cool, yeah. Man.
It's super, super fun, you know, and it's a very unusual gig. It's a lot of fun to do. But, yeah, those parades and those shows are very, very cool.
Yeah, and it's like just totally. Like one last point I wanted to, like, flag again for listeners at home as we were talking about the sweetening on both that and, like, New Year's is... It's easy to like sit there after the fact and be like, oh, they're cheating, they're faking it all. But it's like, but the job isn't always to present exactly what's there, because exactly what's there might sound like trash sometimes. The job is to recreate the experience of being there. And right. Those are very different goals.
It's the entertainment business. It's supposed to be entertaining. Ready, go, entertain people. You know what I mean? Well, the
other thing is that every time I do, you know, a news show, like the Today Show, you know, or ABC, any one of those shows where you have a musical artist come out and they're performing for a crowd, you know, to try and help sell their product, how much of that do you really think is a live performance? You know, we want it to sound like the record. How often is that actually going to be a live performance? Well, Sean's pretty close with that great big zero he's holding up in his hand. A lot of times they'll sing live to track, you know, sometimes, you know, but most of the time I would recommend, hey, look, you know, if you really want it to sound like the record, you should use the record. If you want it to sound like the recording, if that's what you're selling the recording, you know, I got to sell you. You know, when we go to a lot of the live shows, how much of those shows are track? A lot of the shows we hear are, you know, are track. So much of it is really well produced. Some of it is just put together. And let's not talk about the artists who use a ton of auto-tune. I mean, you know, we all know there's a ton of artists who are using auto-tune, you know, all the time, you know.
What? No. That's
crazy. How insane,
no.
Right? I mean, I love it when you do a rapper and the biggest part of his entourage is the guy whose job is to do the auto-tune, you know. You go and you look at his rundown sheet and it's like, hey, are these the songs we're going to do? Yep, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And like, you have your settings? Say, yep, I'm setting for this song, my setting for this song, my setting for this song, my setting for this song. You know, it's all about trying to keep them in the pocket. Trying to protect the integrity of the client and keep them where they're supposed to be. But, you know, so totally. when they're trying to sell that on morning TV, you know, sometimes they play live. Sometimes is that the best choice? Sometimes it's not. Sometimes the best choice is live, and that's awesome. You know, but sometimes they just want to sell the record, and in that case, a lot of times they'll just play, and you know, and the singer will sync back to it, you know. And I can't blame them at all, especially when you're doing this at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, trying to do a 7 a.m. radio hit or a 7 a.m. TV hit. You know, it's not easy to do.
Totally. And it depends on what they're selling, right? Like if what they're selling is not like authentic singer-songwriter stuff, it's not maybe a big deal to be playing to the track. You know what I mean? If it's just a, you know, like pop record or something, it's not like most of that's tracks anyway when it was made, you know? But
yes,
if it's like a, you know, super authentic singer-songwriter thing, maybe it makes more sense to play it live, you know?
Sometimes it does, you know, but that's the thing is it really depends on the moment. So you kind of want to be flexible with it, you know.
Totally.
But it's important to know that, you know, it's not cheating if you decide to give them the album version, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, one of the albums I grew up with that I love so much, Dark Side of the Moon, man, that is totally studio. You know, it's not about the live performance. It's all about, you know, what happens if you take those ends. When I had a professor who was like, hey, take this part, sync it together, double it over, spice it. This is actually a cut between the very end of the album and the beginning of the album. Like, mind blown, you know, what the Beatles were doing, you know, with separating some of the stuff they were doing in the studio, you know, was very, very different than anybody had done before. You know, you listen to the experimentation in the early days of stereo and you're like, crap, you know, Beach Boys, nothing like what was happening in the studio. You know, it's a ton of stuff that happens. It's, you know, that's the magic of the recording studio.
Absolutely.
So speaking of the Beatles and of taking recordings that people know well and bringing them back around live, I'm going to try and make a segue here and let's talk about you. You mixed Rain on Broadway for Abe Jacob for a while.
I did.
What was that like? Because I unfortunately didn't get a chance to make it to see it. The one time I had tickets, I had to give them up. But I know, because I mean, that's an artist that everybody knows from the recordings, and they're trying to do it live. So like, how does that work, and like, what challenges does that give you?
Well, it's really cool. So Rain is a tribute, right? So it's a tribute band, and these guys, they do the wigs, they do the costumes, they do the voices. They really work hard to try and emulate the different parts of the Beatles and their albums and the different times that they were performing, right? They're trying to hit iconic moments. And they use every trick in the book to try and make that happen and make it as cool an experience for the audience as humanly possible. So there are some tracks involved, there's some playback, there's some sampling. Most of what they're doing is actually playing it live. And these guys, you know, they learned their instruments because they saw the Beatles and they wanted to be those dudes. So they learned those songs, and they learned them really, really well, and they, you know, joined tribute bands, and this became a mega tribute band.
Cool.
And this, you know, so Rain on Broadway, you know, as these guys tour, you know, the world and the U.S. and Canada constantly, and they wanted to bring this to, you know, to Broadway for a few weeks and make some dough. Well, it was really successful. They extended, changed theaters, you know, extended again, kept on running until, you know, the theater owners were like, we have to put another show in here. Time for you to go. Bye. You know, but we had an amazing run, and I didn't know what it was going to be like. I thought it was exciting. I knew the music. I knew what I was getting involved with. The sound designer was Abe Jacob, you know, the godfather of theatrical sound design, right? The godfather, the original, you know, Broadway sound designer, you know, the guy who did Cats and Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, and he's been a mentor and a friend for many, many years. I was very excited on working that with him and, you know, working on a sound system, mixing a show that was like this. You don't ever get an opportunity to do this, you know? So that part was really, really cool. And the audiences were phenomenal. They had religious experiences. We had people who would come in, and I did not expect this at all, but like people who had gone to see the Beatles at Shea Stadium, who weren't able to actually hear anything because the sound systems were terrible back then. I had people come to me in tears saying, I got to relive what it was like when I was 11 or 12, and I got to hear everything, and it sounded just like the record. And so they had a better experience than they thought. They recreated the experience when they were young, and they made it better by having it be everything they really wanted it to be. Because they saw the guys, you know, they might not have been the right people, or, you know, looked awfully close, sounded really close, but it really sounded just like the record, and they had that live experience. So spectacular stuff. I cannot tell you how many people stop by on a nightly basis or on a show basis to tell me, thank you, it sounded amazing, we had a great time.
Awesome.
When I was mixing Rain, and also when I mixed Rocktopia, like the number of people who stopped by the mixing console to say that was fantastic, you know, the sound was tremendous, it sounded awesome, you know, it was just like so much fun to do, you know, hard to mix, but super, super fun to do. The guys with Rain, they were awesome, and they were tough cookies. They would come out and yell at me if they didn't think I was getting the mix right. They would come up to me and go, look, one of the guys, Joey, he put his finger in my chest. He goes, go home, listen to the record. I was like, all right, I know the song, man. I know the song. He goes, no, go home and listen to the record again. I'm like, okay. I got the note, and I would go home and I'd listen to it and be like, shit, man, he's right. He's right. The bass is louder in this section, and the bass needs to sound just like this. I'm like, all right, you know what? I thought I knew exactly what that song sounded like. it sounded like what I thought about and what I thought was there. But he's listened to that recording more times than I have. He's playing an instrument. He's thinking about it differently than I am. You know, I'm thinking about, how do you tell that story? He's thinking about, how do I tell that story as this person? How do I tell that story in this with this instrument? And I needed that perspective. So, Joey, wherever you are, man, love you. Thank you. All those guys from that band, tremendous people. Steve Landis, you know, I'm not remembering his names at the moment, but man, spectacular bunch of musicians, really talented. And on the one hand, some people were like, oh my God, it's a cover band, it's a tribute band. I had one guy who'd be like, man, it's like the dudes who do this on a cruise ship. Well, it's the guys who do this at the absolute top level in the industry. And, you know, you can make fun of an Elvis impersonator, but you can have a great time. These guys do a tremendous job paying respect to the greatest band of all time, right? So God bless. And I didn't know I was going to love it as much as I did. I loved mixing that show. And when we closed, it was heartbreaking for me. So, I mean, I have, you know, never had an issue when a Broadway show closed. I'm like, this is the nature of our beast. It's the way our business goes. You know, it's all cyclical. It hit me in a very different way when Rain closed, you know, and it was time to say goodbye to this guy. So it was really hard. Like, the tears did not stop. Wow, man. It was rough. But, you know, hey, on to the next thing. I moved on to the next thing, had a great time the next show. But, you know, it's a very special time in my life. And I had no idea how much I was going to love mixing that show.
Awesome. And, you know, for the listeners at home, I want to hammer home, like, that point he made about going home to listen to the record brings us back to, on the live episode, what Ryan was saying the other week about how, like, you can only focus on so many parts of a song at one time. And part of our job is to both know and pick which parts to bring to a listener's attention at any given time to make the song be what it needs to be. And I feel like that's a solid example to, like, kind of hammer that point Ryan made home.
Yeah. But it's funny, you know, when I realized that I'd been making a mistake going, oh, well, that album, I'd been thinking the bass should be in this position all the time. And in that one song that Joey was pissed off about, you know, he's like, the bass is supposed to be here and sound like this to right now. I'm like, you know what? He was right. He was paying all the attention to it, you know, and I was paying attention to a different part of the song. I was listening to the voice. How's it telling the story? What was going on? You know, I was listening to rhythm, harmony, you know, melody. I wasn't listening to the other part of it, what the bass line was doing in that moment and how it changed in the course of the song, right? I was like, do I have my top four things happening? Am I telling the story? Yes. And I had not really paid enough attention to it. And he heard it right away and was like, nope, fix that. And I was like, oh, crap, okay, you know. So it's a great lesson, you know, to make sure you're paying attention to all the elements all the time, you know, and what is the arc for every part of those elements in the song, you know? Every song has that arc, and we think about it, you know, how are we telling the story? But do you think about where every instrument is from the beginning to the end? You know, where does it start? Why does the tambourine come at this one place? Why is there an afuchikabasa that then goes away? You know, how come the singer decided to double these voices in this place? And, you know, why is it there? Or did the producer make that choice? You know, what was done after the fact? What was done during the session? You know, what did they painstakingly decide in, you know, in months and months or days and days in the studio to make this happen this way? So, you know, we have to try and make the best choices that we can to transmit that properly to the audience. And, you know, not only is it a labor of love, but is a great responsibility we carry to make sure that we're trying to get the artist's intention back to the audience.
Right on. Totally.
I feel like, you know, hey man, preaching to the choir.
No, man, but no, it's true. But it's,
yeah. And it's useful both for those of us who know it or think we know it and those who don't. And it's always a good reminder. And I know that's one of the things, like, that I know I've learned over the years of, like, after struggling on, like, longer running shows of, like, you get into the groove of what you think is cool of a song, a scene in a play or whatever, and emphasize that and forget the parts that, like, somebody who's seeing it for the first time may need to get maximum enjoyment or maximum understanding out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, you know, you can go back to a show you've been mixing for years and years and go, man, you know, I wasn't paying attention to that third cello part, but now that this sub has come in and they're murdering it, I really miss having the right part there, you know?
Yeah.
It can be heartbreaking.
Totally.
You know? Well, and if you don't pay attention to it, you know, but when you hear it wrong, you know, your ear goes, what the hell was that, you know?
Totally.
Been there, you know, I've been mixing Chicago. You know, I mixed Chicago off and on for 8 years. And when somebody came in and they clammed on that, man, it was crazy. I remember seeing, you know, some musicians go down in flames and watching what happens live during a show when somebody gets upset with that. It's fascinating to watch that happen.
And,
you know,
and in that show, they're on stage too, which makes it that much more visible.
Yes, they're up there, you know, they're on a riser. Everybody is in the clear. You can see exactly what's happening every second of it, you know. So if I can tell a terrible story about that, we had a sub drummer in, and BB North was starring as Velma. Sub drummer did not have the right cues in the right place, came in and didn't do a great job, was trying his best, didn't have enough time, didn't have enough chance, didn't know enough, did a pretty decent job, but missed some really key parts. Finished the song, struggled through it, made it through. Audience probably noticed a couple of small flubs, wouldn't have known how much it was, but the next book scene starts and I'm hearing smack, thwack, 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 thwack. Pick up the comm. What's going on? BB's kicking the back of the bandstand. She is furious. She's asking for that person to get fired. I was like, oh my God, what's going on backstage right now? This is a big old drama. And I totally understand. Like, it's her butt on stage. You know, she's doing, you know, this incredible acrobatics. She's dancing her heart out, dancing and singing live with no track. You know, she's putting herself out there and she's wearing basically, you know, a tiny piece of underwear and tall heels. And she's putting every bit of energy she has to perform and to kick ass. And this is a huge number. And the timing is very specific. And if somebody doesn't match that timing and they miss their rim shots, well, she's out there looking like an idiot and everybody else looks okay. So I felt horrible for her. But, you know, hey, they fixed it. They got it all taken care of. But and it was when it was happening, it was a sight to behold. You know, it's like being in the middle of the eye of the hurricane going, crap, what's happening next?
Dude.
Good
that
times.
Would be intense.
Yeah.
Just the other end of calm. sounded like the whole place is blowing up.
What is that huge pounding going on backstage? That's BB. You know, this little tiny lady, huge amount of talent, all of that anger, all that frustration. You know, if somebody totally, you know, messing up that number and all the work she's put into it, like, oh God, you know, feeling for the drummer, feeling for BB, you know, feeling for what's going on, and then watching the audience go, we're watching the scene. What's that thumping in the background? Like, you do not want to know.
Totally.
Yeah.
This is a don't ask, don't tell situation.
Well, you know, hey, look, man, long running shows on Broadway, you know, they all have stories about things that have gone well, things that have gone wrong. Crazy stuff. I remember, you know, watching somebody get violently ill in the middle of Cats and people standing up, you know,
Show or in the show?
People who are watching the show get violently ill. I have stories about people who were on stage, like running off stage and puking and going, oh, like having to figure out who was actually throwing up and pull that fader out and then track them throughout the show. Have they made it? Are they on stage? Have they been swapped out yet?
They really nailed the cat sounds in this.
Yeah. Some scary stuff.
You just hit and record the sound and make that a sound effects package for later. You're like, oh, I'm going to sell this to NBC.
Oh, man. I've seen some crazy stuff with like talent going. Like, I remember touring the Full Monty, you know, like one of my first jobs out of school 20 years ago. And we had a lead who decided he did not like his understudy. So help him, that understudy was never going on. So dude went on with like kidney stones, like the couple times he was off stage, like run into the bathroom, buckle it. Like they had the understudy in the wings in costume because he looked so bad. But out of spite, he pushed his way through it. It was awful to watch.
Oh, my gosh.
Kidney stones, man. Oh,
yeah.
That is a new level of pain.
Yep.
I had a doctor tell me, you know, that's as bad as labor. And I was like, not going to say that out loud to anybody I love. But okay.
that's what Sean likes to refer to as the divorce prevention plan.
Yeah, there you go. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. I was doing a play on Broadway. I was doing playback for the show Art that had Alfred Molina and Alan Alda in it. And oh my God, who's that other guy? Who's so phenomenal, brilliant performer. Three stars, three tremendous people. But I passed a kidney stone in the middle of the show. ran downstairs, and like was in such agony. And the stage manager said, "You're a pale guy, but I have never seen you as white as a sheet." Just trying to make it through like the next scene, hit the go button and get through and, you know, mix foot mics at the same time. Oh my God. Terrible, terrible.
At least it passed.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, oof. I have suggestions, people, if you're ever going through that, but I don't think it's worth sharing on a podcast.
I was gonna say, what wine goes with kidney stone? So for those who don't know, Jim also has a wine blog and is a wine connoisseur, as it were. So is one of the best phone-a-friends to have when you need a wine pairing.
Well, there you go. It's funny because I've been on several different podcasts about wine and alcohol and drinking more than I have about broadcast and audio, even though that's been my career for the last 30 some odd years. So it's kind of funny.
I mean, to a certain point, this is a podcast about alcohol and drinking, but
there you go.
Just so indirectly.
Andy's always drinking on our podcast.
I'm still nursing the coffee today.
There you go. We need to phone a friend about cigars, Andy. If JVB is going to be wine, we need to phone a friend about cigars so we can like get it. We need a whiskey friend and a cigar friend. We've already got a bazillion coffee friends, right? I think. We're going to get that covered.
What kind of cigars do you like to smoke?
All of them.
Okay. All right. Damn. I would never say that personally, but okay. It's like, what beer do you like? All the beer? Really? All the beer? Okay.
Oh, man. When I was a drinker, the kind of beer I liked was the cold kind.
Have you stopped drinking since then?
Yeah, I did a couple years ago. I went to the doctor to get a checkup, and they were like, hey, man, are you much of a drinker? And I was like, why, yes, I'm a professional. And they're like, well, if you'd like to see your grandkids, you should stop that. And I was like,
okay.
Jameson, grandkids. And my wife punched me in the shoulder, and she was like, what? I was like, what? She's like, really? I was like, fine, grandkids.
But can we at least name one of them Jameson?
Yeah, totally.
How totally. Can the grandkids are named Jameson, Jack?
Totally.
And you've got four of them all named Rose?
Yeah, right? What? These are my grandkids, Heineken, Jameson.
And the four roses.
That's right. Totally. Rose, and Rose.
Bring her back slightly on topic.
How come you named that baby one Widow Jane? I understand Jane, but why Widow Jane?
Well, yeah, right. Totally. See, all right, to answer your question seriously about cigars, my favorite currently is the My Father the Judge. That's the one I've dig currently. It's easy to find, tasty, and doesn't like make me cross-eyed by halfway through the whole thing. You know what I mean?
Mm. You know, there's a real joy about actual Cuban cigars, and you know how quickly they can make you empty your bowels. It's a beautiful thing.
Totally.
There's something about that nicotine. It's like, huh, who needs prunes and salad when you can smoke the right cigar? And it'll just be like, right? Hang on, I'll be back.
Totally. Man, my other favorite, speaking of that, is the Hoyo de Monterey Epicure Especial. I had a box of those, and man, those were tasty.
Yeah.
Just tasty, but
I'm trying to remember who the manufacturer is who makes the short story. That was a tremendous cigar I used to love. Arturo Fuente.
Yeah, totally. And it's just like a little dude. You can just like get him little, you know what I mean? Get it in quick, almost on a smoke break with your friends that smoke cigarettes.
Exactly. But not quite. I mean, if they're doing a 10-minute smoke break, you can get that in like 12 or 14, but you know, decent ring size, you know.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. For sure. All right, Andy, we got a cigar friend too. Look at that. He's like triple duty right now. Audio, wine, cigars.
I'm no expert when it comes to cigars. I'm no expert at all.
I'm not either, but I need an expert, somebody to, you know, sort me out here.
So bringing it back around a little more audio just to kind of lead us towards an ending.
Why you gotta be the buzzkill, Andy? Why you gotta be the buzzkill?
That's my name is Thanks, Andy Dad. Levis, and
we're going to talk about jazz or Come From Away or talk about television or what?
I mean, at this point, we're bordering on like we got to have you back for like a second whole episode at some point.
Yeah.
So I can talk trash about mixing game shows.
Right.
Into it. The price is wrong, Bob.
Oh, dude. Let me tell you. Okay, Sean, I'll give this short, little short story, right? My first day on a set of a game show, everybody welcomes me and they go, welcome to the Sausage Factory. I'm like, excuse me? I mean, that's, you know, it's what they do day in, day out, garbage in, garbage out. It's like five or six episodes a day. And it's just like cranking this turd out as it goes. So,
okay.
Yep. Yep. And that's why I did that for like a year and a half and then said, never again. Never again.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Good times. Jobs you don't want to have.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Well, you know, it's like the guy who mixes a bar band in a place where they throw beer, right?
Dude, how frustrating.
Right?
I've mixed plenty of bar bands in my life, but never at a place where they throw beer. But the one time that somebody gets too drunk and throws a beer, you're like, that's enough. Nope. I couldn't do it at a whole place that was literally like Roadhouse, you know what I mean? Where it was like chicken wire and like Somebody could. I'm sure that's a good time for somebody, but I'd lose my noodle.
Look, and we're not going to kink shame.
Hey, Andy, you're allowed to have whatever you want, man.
Right?
Yeah, right? Totally. I see your chicken wire at the back of your screen there, buddy.
Dude, Blues Brothers. Much, much love.
Yeah, man.
But Roadhouse. Very funny
for
story.
For sure.
Patrick, rest his soul, Patrick Swayze did a cover as Billy Flynn on Chicago the Musical. So really, I have a couple fun stories about that. But well, I'll have to talk with Andy's other half, Kate, about that before I ever talk about it on a podcast.
Uh-oh.
Well, you know, Kate mixes it now, right? She's covering for John. She and John Patron's making the show.
Yeah, well, at some point we're going to do a Chicago hour because once I can line up schedule with John, he's going to come on. Alyssa, who's the other cover, may pop in as a guest host to give John shit because you got to have somebody to give John shit.
Excellent.
Yeah. Maybe you can get
Jenny Montgomery to give John shit.
I mean, do that too. So John and Jenny are another New York sound couple that we're friends with. And yeah, John is at this point the longest tenured mixer on any Broadway show. Mm-hmm. A couple years ago, he passed Craig Cassidy on Mamma Mia.
Yep. God bless him.
Yep.
I cannot tell you how happy I was. I was like, he was my sub when I was running out the door in Chicago, and he figured out how to keep his head down and keep a job there. And he's a better man than I. I love him to death. He's a great guy.
Yeah, no, he's a good guy. And we were actually just texting today about trying to figure out when we can get him on.
Excellent.
Nice.
Well, when you decide you want to do a podcast to talk about mounting microphones, you know, in all types of people in all types of situations, you should do the Hour with Jenny Montgomery.
Yep.
I totally want to know about that. Like, I do the straightforward corporate and concert kind of stuff. I am totally into learning about all the weird mounting of microphones on people and stop signs. And, dude, tell me all about it. I want to know. Give me the weird shit. I'm here for the weird shit, bro.
There you go. I'll have to hire Jenny. Bring Jenny on for that one.
Yep, we're definitely talking about like maybe bringing like Kate, Jenny, Skip, like some of that whole gang together and talk about a bunch of the stuff they do. I can't say for sure because there's the intros and Can You and Will You are still out, but definitely on my list of stuff we're trying to make happen.
Well, it's very funny because all the corporate shows that we have at Jazz, you know, when I find out what's going on, like the first series of phone calls, I'll call Kate, I'll call Jenny, I'll couple of the absolute top people and say, are you available? Is there any chance you might want to come work at Jazz and do this? Like, you know, what do I have to do? Like, do I make you cookies? You know, come and join. What can I do? I'll be like, hey, Kate, Andy will drive you.
I mean, cookies works 90% of the time, right?
Yeah. So we generally have a rule here that I don't talk Kate or us on the podcast. But there's one story that I think she'll let me get away with telling because Jim's here.
Careful! Don't end up on the couch, bro.
I'm treading carefully. But we did. It was a couple years ago at Jim's previous house gig. Jim had a gig that he needed an A1 or an A2 for, and he booked us both and was like, "Are you two cool working together?" And we were like, "Yeah." And so we walk into the room. And Jim looks at us, says, here's the rundown of what the day is. One of you is the A1, one of you is the A2, and spun around on his heel and walked out of the room.
And you were like, babe, which one do you want to do? I'll do the other one.
Oh, no, I was straight up, you want to mix, right? And she was like, yep. And I was like, cool, I'll start battering up. And it was a great day.
Good talk.
That's another
man that's on the divorce prevention program.
Well, I always readily say, and I say this to her too, I am solidly the second best mixer in my house.
Nice.
Smart man. It's also really good. You know, I try to put together teams of people who can do a lot of different things and do it well. So I know that I had people who could do just about anything, and you have lots of reasons why you might want to be in one position or another on a given day. And sometimes, you know, it's difficult for me at Jazz when I have to select some of my best people and be like, you're going to be behind the console. You're going to do everything else. You're going to be, you know, in this room, you're going to be doing that. You're going to be doing comm. You're going to be doing wireless. You're going to be moving stuff around. You know, it's like, sometimes you need people to do other jobs. You need the best people to do something else because sometimes the hardest job is not throwing faders. You know, sometimes the hardest job is dealing with the shit that's going to come down the pike in the course of the day.
Totally. Right?
The number of, oh, by the ways that happen in our business, especially in corporate. Oof.
Yeah.
Totally.
You know, I'm going to ask one more question to kind of wrap this up, just because I know Jim's got to get going and we're running long, but we definitely got to get you back on because we've got many, many more topics we can touch on that I would love to.
We'll talk jazz later.
Yeah, dude, talk jazz, talk some of the more recent Broadway. I mean, we could just do a whole episode probably with you on the evolution of mixing on Broadway, because from starting with like like almost pre-VCA automation, right? If you go back far enough.
Or yeah, totally. Yeah, well, CATS was the pre-A type. So it did not have VCAs. It was mixing inputs into groups, into matrices.
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot of stuff we'll bring you back on and talk about. But just to wrap this one up, I know you mentioned earlier when we were talking about Rain about how like Abe was a mentor of yours. And I know it's like it's been something that I think you've tried to carry on very much, both, you know, going as far back like 20 years ago when I was in college to folks today of like mentoring folks and, you know, kind of helping guide people in the industries and, you know, sometimes just helping people avoid making the mistakes you might have made. And if we were going to wrap that up, if for like younger listeners starting out in the industry now, if you had like one piece of advice you could give them, what would that be?
Listen with your ears. Ask a lot of questions, but listen. You will learn so much by hanging out with the people who've been doing this for a while. And, you know, like if you sit there and you're quiet in the background, you pay attention to what's happening, you'll learn an awful lot about the room. But, you know, you can't hear when you're busy talking about stuff. So like we're sitting here chatting away, having a great time. But like if we're sitting in a rehearsal room, you know, I'm going to be my best job being silent to try and hear everything else that's going on. Right. So people will try and listen. They'll say they're listening while they're having a conversation. You're not really going to pay attention that way. But you have to really spend some time, you know, putting your ears to it and listen to what your friends are saying, what your compatriots are saying. You get into a room, finally, you want to listen to what the people who've been doing this for a while have to say. You might figure out something that they've been missing. You might figure out what they've been doing and the secrets of the trade that they haven't shared with you. You know, you might figure out a lot of different things. You're going to figure out certainly the temperature of the room, who's in charge, you know, who's calling the shots, what the issues are, if you pay attention. You know, but you have to actually really listen to what's going on in the room, whether it's a rehearsal for a band or a rock concert or a corporate event or whatever it might be, you know, or even just a production meeting. You know, who's in charge? You know, what's missing? What's happening here? You know, and get a real sense of what's happening. But for mixing, oh man, there's a lot to learn. There's so much technique, and it took me years before I really understood somebody else showing me, you know, what the difference is when you do compressive mixing and you are making adjustments on the syllable and half syllable and why you would make those adjustments on the syllable and half syllable. So much, you know, finesse that goes into mixing a Broadway show. And there's the differences that we use for mixing television are radically different. And it's a really different process. You know, what you're trying to accomplish, it's not the same kind of emotional, expressive translation to a live audience. When we're doing television, you're really mixing in to try and make sure that you're having the right thing come out from the codec that you're putting into it. You know, it's all about your compression and your balances and your stems and how you're able to do multiple mixes and multiple formats at the same time. It's very technically inclined, and yet there still is an art to it. But like when I mix music for air, you know, I have a very different approach to what I'm doing than when I'm mixing music for live. Was that a very roundabout
answer? No, man, that's totally.
No, and I feel like that was even a couple tidbits all in one.
I guess one last question while you were talking about just the difference of that. Is there something about mixing the music for broadcast that technically, you're saying they're different, but like, is it technically very different? Are there different levels? Are there different like aggressive or less aggressive treatments to it? Or, you know, how is it technically very different for you?
When you listen back to the delivery system that your broadcast is going on, it's going to have a compression codec that will or will not agree with what you've done previously. So I think it's very important that you do compressive mixing going into it in a different way than what we would do for theater, but to try and keep things in the right ballpark. You know, whether you're mixing for Lufs or off of VU, you're trying to keep it in the right pocket. Trying to have the right amount of dynamic response, yet having it be loud enough or soft enough to be, you know, in a car or a loud environment or in a podcast or, you know, whatever it's going to come back to when you're watching it on YouTube later, or, you know, in a compressed format or on your computer. You know, all those things have an effect. And I have 30 years of the benefit of being able to listen back to my content because I spend the time going back and listening to my work after the work is done, right? And hearing that back and going, boy, I don't like the way that worked. I know what I listened to when I was mixing it. I know how it delivered. I have a recording back from it. But this is how this codec treated it. This is how this codec treated it. And in the last 10 years, the way that our compression algorithms have changed. So, you know, the volume wars, right? 15, 20 years ago was a whole other thing, right? How loud can it be?
Now I got a studio background. I'm with you.
Wars. There you go. Okay. So now it's the codec wars, which is, am I getting back what I'm putting out? No, does it sound the same? Should it sound the same? How should it sound? Right. So how you mix for television really makes a difference.
So you're listening back to your desk mix going, man, the desk mix is smoking. And then you listen to the after the codec or the broadcast mix, and you're like, man, that's not the same thing. Kind of like when we're in the studio listening to what's happening in the studio, and then you listen to it on FM radio, and you're like, what did they do to my freaking song? Right.
Right.
Okay, I got you.
If you're listening to it, you know, on the big reds, and that's why, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, you know, we'd listen to everything. You'd take a cassette deck, you listen to it in your car, you listen to it in a boom box, you listen to it in every possible arena. Because you want to listen to it. What's it going to sound like when it sounds like ass, right? So that's why if you made something sound good, like in an awful tone, you know, okay, that mix translates. If it sounds good on NS10s, it'll sound good, you know, in most systems, right? It'll sound good in most mediocre sound systems. And that's the same kind of thing, as you're listening to it going, all right, I'm listening to it on Genelex. That's not the same as the computer, the speaker that I've got. It's not the same as the ear pods that you're listening to. It's not the same as somebody's cheap $3 headphones, you know, or somebody else's, you know, equivalent version of a mono TV speaker someplace, right?
For sure.
So best case scenario, worst case scenario, and then the codecs, because they're all different, you know, each of the different formats that something's going to go into, you know, each of those different encoders is a different codec. They all treat audio differently. And the first time that I heard back a mix where Satellite had stripped out the bottom 100 cycles, and I had no bass guitar and no kick drum in a mix, and I was like, what the heck is going on with my TV mix, right? Like, my phone is ringing. I'm in the middle of a live broadcast, and the guy who's the front of house mixer for this artist who's in the hotel room, you know, somewhere far, far away, is like, dude, where's the kick drum? Like, come listen to the mix. He goes, I can't. I'm way far, far away. But I was like, okay, you're on the phone. Can you hear the kick drum in the mix here? He's like, yeah. But the kick drum is there. It is not in the air mix, right? So,
dude.
I'm screaming at my A2. I need the broadcast transmission guy to get in here. I need to get a confirmation mix back in here so I can hear what's going on. He's like, we are on the edge of the satellite. We got the edge of the bird. I don't have full frequency range. It's going up there. It's sounding great. I'm like, it's sounding great. He goes, everything is there. I'm like, something is not there. I'm like, can I hear this back? There was nothing happening below like 160 cycles, you know? So it's like, well, and that teaches me, right? So instead of wanting to have the feel of the kick drum, I needed to have something else to make that happen. So, you know, not only was I learning what wasn't happening, but I also need to learn, what do I need to do to make up for that?
Sure,
and it may not be the right sound artistically, but I need to make sure somebody can hear that instrument, you know, if it's being missed, you know, whether that's the technical issue of the bird or not, you know, it's up to me to make sure it's there.
Sure. Totally. Do you find yourself like compressing those entire mixes into the codec more to keep it more even than you would for a typical live show, or not necessarily? How do you manage those different codecs? Do you make that package tighter with compressor or?
I raise the overall volume of my mix, and I keep a very specific dynamic range. Like, I try to make sure that my dynamic range is between 12 and 16 dB. And I try to make sure that my floor starts at a level that's way higher than I would if it was a recording or a live show.
Word.
But so for air, I really raise the bottom of my position. I'm, you know, working hard, trying to make sure that the noise is gone. Now, the funny part is, if it's a show where there's dead air or there's ever silence in it, you know, you got to make sure that your silence is still silent, right? So your dynamic range gets really, really wide. But it was like the first time I listened to, you know, like you said, like an FM transmission, and you go, well, gee, something took my mix and went and squished it way down. For the radio, for the audience listeners at home, JVB just took two wide fingers and squished it way down super narrow. You know, compressed the living hell out of my mix. And I was like, okay, so how does that work? You know, if I'm listening to Holst, you know, the planets, you know, and I hear that dynamic range in a concert hall, and you try and relate that to, you know, a record pressing. Well, gee, there's an awful lot of noise in that. It doesn't translate the same way. Other engineers have dealt with this before us, you know, that's why there are some of the most spectacular compressors and limiters available in the world. You know, the Fairchild was built for a reason, right? Even the DBX algorithms were built for a reason, right? So all those are, you know, but the question is, how are people using them? And we're not necessarily being taught the same way that people were doing it. You know, we want to learn DECA for a specific reason, but like the compression, the limiting, it's really important. So as technology changes, those codecs are changing. We have to change with the times, make sure we're doing the right thing. You know, those online discussions about, oh, how many lufs? Yeah, it's really important. You need to pay attention to it, because if you're mixing for those mediums, it's got to be right. Think of the guys who are doing the music and the sound effects for video games right now, you know? It's crazy stuff, you know, getting the gunshots and the you know, voices and the responses back and the music in the right place, and how does all that work? And the fact that it has to be able to constantly adjust given where a player is in a given moment, it's fascinating stuff, you know?
Dude, totally.
So we can talk about this all day long.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But we're pushing an hour and a half here, so we should totally wrap this up.
We'll wrap it up there.
I'm sorry for asking 9,000 questions.
No, I'm sorry for boring the crap out of you.
No,
not dog.
Clearly we're all having a good time. And I will throw it out to listeners, too, if you want to email. And we'll definitely work on having Jim back for more stories in another episode. So signal2noise, that's the number 2, at prosoundweb.com. It's in the show notes. You know, we're always open to suggestions. But also, if you have questions you want us to ask Jim, if we were open back in for another episode, send them our way. Otherwise, I'm Andy Levis. That's Sean Walker, Jim Van Bergen, and we're brought to you as always by our sponsors RCF and Allen and Heath. And this has been another episode of Signal to Noise on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for inviting me, guys. Appreciate you.
Thanks for coming.